Welcome to Season 6 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we're continuing our journey of broadening our knowledge in the field of combat sports science by speaking to experts in the fields of nutrition science, psychology, strength and conditioning, and much more to help you become the best practitioner you can be. Today, our guest on the podcast is Dr. Amy Bender. Dr. Amy is the Director of Clinical Sleep Science at Cerebra in Calgary, Canada. She has a PhD and Master of Science degrees in Experimental Psychology from Washington State University, specializing in sleep EEG. She's a former athlete herself, notably a Hall of Fame basketballer, keen mountaineer, and in 2009 she completed an Ironman. Dr. Amy's interest in sleep crossover both health and performance, and she is the go-to sleep science consultant for many elite-level teams, including Team Canada, who are about to head off to Tokyo for the 2021 Olympic Games. In this episode, Dr. Amy breaks down why we sleep, how our body regulates it, what the stages of sleep are, and answers a few age-old myths with a dose of science. There's a lot to cover, so let's get to it. All right, the lady has told us that recording is in progress, which means we are live. So back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast, joined by another very, very special guest all the way from Calgary, Canada. We've got Dr. Amy Bender. Dr. Amy, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I will do a public apology because this is probably the biggest kerfuffle I've had trying to get a guest on the podcast, and I'll fall on my shield there. We tried to do this maybe three or four times. I think we went back and forth and changing dates. And then we were meant to do it a few weeks ago when I was in our quarantine and in my 2 week prison that we didn't have any internet, so we couldn't do it. So I'm glad that we're finally here and we're doing this.
Yes, me too. You might have to translate kerfuffle for me. I don't really, we don't speak that
stuff
word
around. I guess that's what we would call it, a stuff around.
Okay. That makes a little more sense here.
Yeah. So Dr. Amy, for the listeners who may not have heard of you before, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and where your area of expertise lies?
Sure. I started in the sleep field about 15 years ago as a sleep technologist. Basically went to my aunt's sleep lab. She showed me where all the electrodes were placed on the head, the scalp, you know, the chin, the eyes, looking at respiratory signals, and then how that translated into different sleep stages across the night, and was pretty much hooked. So ended up calling every sleep lab in my area, see if I could volunteer, and landed a job at a world-renowned, it was serendipitous, landed a job at a world-renowned sleep lab that was just starting up. It was the Sleep and Performance Research Center at Washington State University, and I was the main sleep technologist there for a few years. So we would hook participants up with electrodes, you know, to look at all these sleep signals during the night, and do studies where there were 62 hours of sleep deprivation. So people would miss two nights without sleep. And we would look at kind of cognitive performance and how that impacted the sleep EEG. And was really fascinated by that and just loved research, loved science. And so wanted to kind of go beyond the sleep technologist role and ended up getting my master's and PhD in experimental psychology, focusing on sleep EEG. And after that, wanted to combine my passion for athletics and sport, being an athlete my entire life. You know, I played three sports in high school. I played college basketball. I did an Ironman in 2009, did some mountaineering. And so really wanted to combine, I kind of saw a need for more information on sleep getting to athletes just based on my own experience as an athlete and my college basketball coach telling me, okay, get a good night's sleep. And that was kind of the end of the information. It's like, well, how do we do that? And so ended up doing a postdoc at University of Calgary, working with Canadian Olympic team athletes, optimizing their sleep, and then have kind of taken that from there to my current role as Director of Clinical Sleep Science at Cerebra, which is a sleep technology company. And we're really focused on in-lab data in the home. So able to do some of these sleep studies in the home and look at sleep quality on a much more sensitive, fine-grained level versus just looking at all the sleep stages across the night. So really enjoying that and, you know, working with teams and athletes along the way.
I've got to ask you, Dr. Amy, because we run in-house studies with our athletes when they're making weight. And when obviously anyone who's had the diet knows that you get pretty grumpy, but what was it like trying to deal with participants when you've sleep deprived them for 62 hours?
It was interesting. It was so interesting. I mean, number one, their mood changed like that, you know, so they would be a lot more emotional. We would see more, you know, crying occurring. Mood was kind of the first thing that we noticed. And I think it was interesting because during these studies, all you could do was basically say their name to wake them up. So they would be doing performance tests. They were doing reaction time tests, you know, and they would nod their head, fall asleep. And basically all we'd do is be like, okay, wake up, you know, we'd call out their name. But I think the interesting part that I learned from all of this, and maybe we'll get to this later, is the circadian rhythm and how that played a role in sleep and alertness in general. So it was interesting to me that even after, let's say, hour 60, they were more alert, and this is around 8 p.m. at night, than when they were at hour, let's say, 22, when it's, you know, 4 in the morning, let's say. So that was something interesting that I learned pretty quickly, is that it's not just about the amount of sleep loss or in a row. It's also the circadian rhythm plays a factor in our levels of alertness and sleepiness.
So were they first year university kids doing this?
There were, our age range was up to age 40. So we actually had, we had some college students, and then also we had some older people participating as well. I wouldn't call them older now because I'm over 40 now, but, we were studying all the ages up to 40.
I was going to say zero sympathy for the first years, because you got to do it as a rite of passage. I remember being poked and prodded by psychologists. I think I had one where like my eyeball got shocked as part of my first year participation. It was something horrible. It was very traumatic. And I just...
You did it all for the money or...
No, we had to do it. I remember as part of our university, all first years had to do so many hours of participation in PhD. So it was a bit of a rite of passage. So at least where I'm from. But let's get into it, Dr. Amy, because I think the very first question I want to ask, and this would be probably super basic for you, but let's lay the foundation here. Why do we sleep? What's the importance of it? Why do humans sleep?
It's actually an interesting question. I think a lot of sleep scientists debate why we sleep in the first place. You know, if sleep didn't serve an absolute vital function, it's the biggest mistake the evolutionary process ever made. So we know it's important. You know, we spend a third of our lives sleeping, and we haven't really evolved to need less sleep. And so we do know that it's important. There's different reasons why scientists think we sleep. I think in general, it's to recover from the physical and mental demands across the day. During sleep, we see memory improves. We see lots of hormonal changes during sleep, and with sleep loss, we see some of those negative impacts. In general, just overall to kind of repair and recover from our overall wakefulness.
Can you talk to us about what the sleep chronotypes are, and can you shed some truth to this? Because I think everyone can appreciate, you know, they know that person that's the morning person that can get up and they're bright bean and they're jumping around and they're full of energy. And then that person who's so slow to get out of bed, but then they're up all night. Is there truth to that? And are these sleep chronotypes a real thing?
Yes, they are. They are. And they're influenced partly by genetics. So if you are more of a night owl, potentially that was handed down from, you know, a family member potentially. About 15% of us are night owls, 15% of us are early birds, and the rest of us kind of fall in between 70% or more of an intermediate type. And so the night owls, you know, they're wanting to go to bed after midnight, even later for some individuals. And the early birds kind of in general are wanting to go to bed early and wake up early before 6 a.m., let's say. And so there is, yeah, there is truth to that. And it actually does change as we age as well. So when we're an adolescent, we are more likely to be a night owl versus when we're in early childhood. And then when we're in late adulthood, we kind of revert back to more of that early bird type. But I think it's important for people to understand that it is related to biology. So if you are more of a night owl and you find yourself not getting tired until late at night, it's likely that your melatonin isn't being released till later. And so it's important to try and align our circadian rhythms with our biology, with that melatonin release. A lot of time that's not possible in our society because we have to wake up early for work, for school, et cetera. And so there are tips and tricks that people can do to try and shift their circadian rhythm to an earlier time if they are a night owl. So for example, melatonin is useful in that situation. Light in the morning is really important. And then blocking light at night with potential blue light blocking glasses.
Yeah, and it's such a big thing now, isn't it? And you see that with a lot of athletes using melatonin to kind of sync their cycles and using the blue light. Can we take a step back, I guess, for the listeners? Can you just explain circadian rhythm, melatonin? What is it? How does this all work together to determine our sleep?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are two main processes that regulate our sleep-wake cycles. The first one is the homeostatic process. So this is process S. And so what this means is the longer you've been awake, the more adenosine buildup in the brain. So adenosine is a byproduct of ATP, so energy during the day. So we have adenosine buildup across the day, and adenosine actually makes us sleepy. So what caffeine does is it blocks the receptors for the adenosine to attach. And so that's why caffeine can make us more alert during the day or in the evening for that matter. Now, when it comes to, there's also the circadian rhythms as well, which play a role in our sleep-wake cycles, as I mentioned previously in the studies I was working with. And circadian rhythms, it's just circa, about, dia, day. So about 24-hour rhythms is what we're talking about here. And we have a master clock in our brain that helps regulate those 24-hour rhythms all the way out to our cells. So even our skin has circadian rhythms related to that as well. And so these 24-hour rhythms kind of tell us when to be alert and when to be awake. And light is our biggest Zeitgeber. It's our biggest cue for our circadian rhythms. And so that's why it's important to get lots of light in the morning to help set our circadian rhythms for the day, which will then lead to better sleep quality, and then also block light at night. So in an artificial environment, you know, you may be, if we didn't have electrical lighting, you would naturally just start to get sleepy as, you know, as it gets dark out. But because of our electrical lighting, we start to see, you know, people being more alert because light tells our brain to wake up and it reduces our melatonin. And so melatonin is a marker of circadian rhythm. And like I mentioned, if you're more of that night owl, you're going to be releasing melatonin later versus more of an early bird who may be releasing melatonin earlier. And so, yeah, it's important for a good light cycle. So again, lots of light in the morning and then trying to block light at night in order to regulate our circadian rhythms and lead to better sleep quality.
Going back to your 62-hour sleep deprived, I want to call them zombies, but I won't be that insensitive. But if we go back to them, when you were talking about once they've been up for a while, it got to 8 p.m. and they seemed a bit more energized. Is that because of these sleep-wake cycles?
Yeah, it's specifically related to that circadian rhythm because, you know, they're at hour 60 and 8 p.m. is generally a time of alertness according to our circadian rhythms. We do have the homeostatic process to counteract that, but that's why in this instance, they were more awake. We hardly ever had to wake a person up during this time. And it's because of the circadian rhythms that was regulating that. And so there is individual differences in when those rhythms are optimized, for example. So a night owl may get more energy at night, you know, maybe even 10 p.m., for example. And so if that person is trying to go to sleep at 10 p.m., it's going to be really challenging. It may lead to insomnia. And so, yeah, it's our circadian rhythms that help kind of control our feelings of alertness and sleepiness throughout the day.
In your experience, is there a way to change that? Is there a way to change these circadian rhythms with exposure to light or using supplements? Is there a way to change them to, say, better suit your lifestyle? Or if you're set at a certain chronotype, you kind of have to play into that.
Yeah, I mean, for example, let's say you're working with MMA athletes, you know, who probably compete at night for the most part. So in that example, we would want to shift their rhythms to a later time. So if they are competing at night, we would actually want to block light in the morning when they're first waking up. We would want them to go to bed later, sleep in later. And as soon as they wake up, we would want to actually potentially wear sunglasses or blue light blocking glasses to shift their circadian rhythms to a later time. And so, and also get lots of light at night prior to this competition, because that's going to make them more alert. It's going to reduce their melatonin production and just in general, overall shift their rhythms to a later time when they need to be performing. I am working with a number of Olympic athletes, you know, and a lot of the competition times are at weird hours. So, you know, it would be important to help shift their rhythms to more of that competition time. And it can be challenging because then they're juggling, you know, they may have a semifinal at, you know, 11 and then 11 a.m., whereas the finals don't occur till 10 p.m. So you got to kind of give and take in that situation. But I think for a lot of the athletes you're working with, utilizing that strategy can help adjust their circadian rhythm to be more optimal depending on when they're competing. And, you know, for example, the triathlete, you'd probably want to do the opposite and getting lots of light in the morning and then blocking light at night, trying to go to bed early, wake up early.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I think back to, I think it was September last year. I don't know if this as a sleep scientist is going to be the worst thing you've ever heard, but when we traveled, we had to go to Abu Dhabi. And because of the time that we were competing, the guys were competing anytime from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. in the morning. So our entire sleep cycle had to shift. And it was a very interesting experience and seeing the guys that who could adjust to it and who couldn't adjust to it, because some of the guys who in particular are real night owls that stayed up late anyway, and they would stay up naturally during that time and they seemed to just fall into it because it fit. But the opposite, the guys that were in bed early kind of struggled a bit more to get into that natural rhythm to be able to adjust.
You know, that is very interesting. You may want to get some expertise from a sleep scientist, because depending on how long the competition is, you could actually opt to not arrive early. And that way, depending on the competition time, their biology in their hometown, so their natural biology in their hometown, travel closer to the event, so that by the time they're competing, it may be at an optimal biology for their internal time. You know, so there's a lot of strategies that people can do depending on when the competition time is. You know, and I think it hasn't fully been tested. I mean, there is travel fatigue related to the trip as well. So you do want to probably arrive a couple of days before, but you may not want to prepare in advance. You know, I actually developed some travel plans for Canadian Olympic athletes traveling to Tokyo. And as a part of that plan, we have them adjust 3 days prior to the trip in the direction that they're going, you know, but there may be an instance where maybe you don't want to pre-adjust prior to the trip, depending on how long the competition is and the timing of the competition.
Yeah, this might be a natural progression. Well, it is in my mind anyway to ask. And not that anyone's doing too much traveling these days with everything that's going on in the world, but everyone's familiar with jet lag, especially when you do the longer flights. And there's that old saying that it takes 1 hour to adjust for every time zone you go through. Is there much truth to that? And how would you deal with going through time zones if you've just flown 14 hours and then your circadian rhythms are completely out of whack to where you are?
Yeah, actually, you adjust faster going west, and that's because our circadian rhythms are longer than 24 hours. So we have a natural tendency to delay our bedtimes, and it's just that environmental light that kind of helps sync us to our own environment. And so it's much easier to travel west and delay versus traveling east and try and advance the schedule. So just to take an example, I did a flight plan and a travel plan for Taekwondo traveling from Manitoba to Tokyo. And, you know, in this case, I believe it was a 13-hour adjustment. So Tokyo was 13 hours ahead. It may have been 14 hours, but they were ahead. And so you could advance your schedule to try and go to bed earlier, wake up earlier, you know, for 14 hours, because that's what it would take to advance your schedule to Tokyo time. Or you could delay your schedule by 10 hours. And because it's easier to delay, in this case, I recommended that they delay their schedule pre-trip heading into that. So go to bed later, wake up later, get light in the evening, block light in the morning, adjust your training schedules to later as well, because it is faster. And some people say almost twice as fast to delay as it is to advance. And so it's, you know, typically you can delay 1.5. Potentially 2 hours each day per time zone change, if that makes sense. But doing this 3 days ahead of the trip, you get a jump start on that process as well. You don't want to really go beyond the 3 days because you have your environmental cues playing a role here. But in this instance, they were 14 hours ahead, which meant that they would have needed to advance their schedule. But because they only needed to go 10 more hours in the delay arena, that's what I recommended in this case. And then on the return trip, I recommended to delay because, again, they have a 14-hour delay, which is going to be faster than a 10-hour advance, if that makes sense. I know it can be kind of complicated, but yeah, it just depends on where you're traveling to, the direction, and even potentially being an early bird could play a role here. So if I find it very easy to advance, you know, in those instances, it may be better to advance the schedule if they're traveling to Tokyo, if they find that to be the case. Now, the majority of people, I think it's around 70%, have circadian rhythms longer than 24 hours.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. And I'm sure we'll get into that a bit more when we talk about sleep aids and supplements that we can use to assist with that. Before we go any further, though, can we talk about sleep itself and what's going on in your body, in your brain, everything when you are sleeping? What's the process when we hit the pillow and we go to sleep? What's happening?
Mm-hmm. Well, parts of our brain can actually be more awake during sleep than they are when we're awake. So especially during REM sleep, we can be more alert than if we're actually awake. So REM sleep looks a lot like waking sleep when we're looking at the brainwave activity. So REM is rapid eye movement sleep. We also have non-REM sleep, so non-rapid eye movement sleep. Not a very creative name here, but that's what the founders called it. And so non-REM sleep is stages 1, 2, and 3. So 1 is the lightest stage of sleep, takes up about 5% of our sleep time across the night. Stage 2 takes up about 50% of our sleep time across the night. And then stage 3 is the deepest stage of sleep, which takes up about 20% of our sleep time across the night. And REM sleep is about 25%. During sleep, we are pruning memories. We are, hormones are being released. So for example, growth hormone is being released during deep sleep. We have testosterone being released. So a number of different hormones are being optimized during sleep. Tissues are being repaired, muscles are being repaired. And then also those memory aspects, like I mentioned. And in general, there's been some recent research showing that the glymphatic system is taking place when we're asleep. So what happens is neurons in the brain shrink to allow cerebrospinal fluid to flow through. So our brain is acting like a dishwasher during sleep, and it's clearing out a lot of these toxins during the night. So that's another important function of what's going on when we're sleeping.
Yeah, that's awesome. And a lot of people, you hear them talk, and I'd love to hear your opinion on this, because in the business world, it's almost the complete opposite to what I hear in the sports performance world, where, you know, in the sports performance, they'll say, you know, you got to get 8 hours sleep, eight plus hours sleep. And then I have a few business mentors that kind of say, you know what, like, sleep later on. You've got to get the work done, sleep 4 to 6 hours. That's all you need. And you feel it, right? And I think everyone can appreciate when you get 4 to 6 hours sleep and you wake up and you go, oh man, I don't feel great, as compared to say when you get 8 hours. I've got two questions for you, Dr. Amy. Is there a difference in total time of sleep? And how much of a role does the quality of the sleep that you get play?
This is a really good question, and something in my current role I'm actually trying to figure out. You know, in general, we need about 7 to 9 hours of sleep per night. 9 hours may be a bit on the high end, but for an athlete, we think that they need more just in order to recover from the physical and mental demands for the sport. So for example, when I did an Ironman, I basically needed a week of at least 10 hours of sleep to recover from that type of event. Because of the physical demands, the mental demands, you know, we think that you need more sleep based on that. So for an athlete, probably need more sleep than maybe a business person. However, when we are sleep deprived, so when we're getting day in and day out, 5 hours, 6 hours, we actually lose our judgment. And so we think that we're performing well, but in reality, when we look at their performance, they are tanking. They're having lapses of attention. They're having longer reaction time. Their mood is impaired. They're making riskier decisions. You know, so you may think that you are performing well on 5 hours of sleep day in and day out, but if we were to study your performance, it would likely be that you would be bombing it. And it's just that our brain, there's loss of prefrontal cortex activity, decision-making. We just aren't making clear decisions and we think we're doing okay. And in reality, there are short sleepers out there. But when you look at, for example, one mutation they found where a father-son duo were getting 4 hours, 4.5 hours per night, and they looked at how frequent that was occurring, and it was 1 in 4 million people. So in general, we think, you know, it's maybe about 1-2%, maybe 3% of the population who can get by on less sleep. Now, when it comes to quality, this is very interesting for me and something I'm very interested in. I think that if you do have better sleep quality, that you can then get away with less sleep at night. So quality does play a role. So it's not just about quantity. It's also about quality. It's also about the timing of your sleep as well. So sleeping during the day is not going to be as good as sleeping at night when your melatonin is being released. So it's all three of those factors. And here at Cerebra, the company I'm working with, we have the technology to study this. And so we're going way beyond sleep stages. We're going way beyond deep sleep. We're looking at different combinations of sleep across the night. You know, and if you were looking at sleep stages, it would be stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, REM sleep and wake. We're looking at over like 10,000 different combinations by evaluating the brain waves, decomposing those brain waves into delta, theta, alpha, beta, these different brain waves, giving a number associated with those brain waves, how much power is in those brain waves. And then we're looking at all these different combinations across the night. So we're trying to really pinpoint what is good quality sleep using our technology. And I really do believe, I know sleep scientists would probably disagree with me, but I think if you are getting better sleep quality, that you don't need as much sleep as if you were maybe not getting quite as good and sleeping, you know, longer.
I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of the wearable technologies. A lot of your athletes probably wear them as well, and say wearable rings, Oura rings and things like that. What are your thoughts on those technologies to use as an assessment tool to assess your sleep quality?
You know, I think they're good at starting the conversation, you know. So I was working with an NBA team, and you know, some of the things I disagreed with, as far as there is a function with Oura Ring, for example, where you can turn off the feedback, which I think is really important in a situation where I'm in a playoff game and I don't want to know if I got a poor night's sleep the night before, you know, so there's good systems in place to check that, at least with Oura Ring. But in general, you know, they're doing pretty good. But there has been some research work to show that the staging is where we have the issue with these wearables. So they're claiming to measure REM sleep. They're claiming to measure deep sleep, you know, and in this recent study, I was looking at 7 different wearable devices and concluded that they're really good at looking at overall sleep time across the night. However, they don't do a very good job at looking at those different sleep stages. You know, so it's something to keep in mind. There are some limitations, but I think they're good at starting the conversation. How can I, or even what I like to say is they're kind of reliably bad, in that they're still useful for if I, let's say, don't drink alcohol today, does that improve my overall deep sleep, for example? And so it's not about the actual number that you're getting, but about some of these interventions that are occurring and how that's kind of how the data is trending.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm sure you would have really good insights to this with the caliber of athlete you work with, but some of my most elite level athletes that I work with are some of the ones that don't use the sleep wearables, and you can tell, and they just know. And I know when you walk into their room, say if we're on a fight week or getting ready, they'll wake up and you can tell when they've had it, and they'll know as well. And they'll just be, oh gosh, it wasn't that great of a night's sleep. And then some mornings they just wake up and they look fresh as a daisy, and you're like, oh man, like what happened to you? It's like chalk and cheese. They look like two different people, but they don't use any of the technology.
Yeah, no, I think that's an important point actually for those using the technology too, is that to not go straight to the data, you know, really kind of evaluate on your own. How did I sleep last night? Like evaluate on your own and then potentially later on go to the data to see what it said, but just keep in consideration that it may not be, you know, totally accurate. And what I'm excited about too in my role is we are actually developing an EEG wearable to, you know, where a person wouldn't have to use all this in-lab equipment in the home, which we currently have available. But we are developing an EEG wearable, almost like a Band-Aid on the forehead, that someone could wear day in and day out, and also pair that with a digital app to help create behavior change. Because I think wearables can cause anxiety in some instances, you know, with some of the athletes you've probably worked with. But also they're good. They can create behavior change too, you know, depending on the app that comes with it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that's a good point to kind of highlight because I like it. I think there's good feedback in there, and there is, like you said, it's good to start a conversation. I have found with a lot of athletes, it does create this just additional stress that just didn't exist before. And they've become obsessed with looking at these sleep cycles and looking at all this. And then it's an interesting contrast because when they take it off, all that stress disappears and then they seem to be getting better night's sleeps. But it is interesting. And like you say, it's a great conversation starter. But talking on that, and you work with lots and lots of athletes, as I keep saying, what are some of the most common mistakes you see athletes are making just in their day-to-day when it comes to their sleep?
I'd say number one is not having a good pre-sleep routine. So a lot of athletes were, they're sleeping in different environments. You know, they're coming off a competition, they're coming off a late training session, and not having a good pre-sleep routine is definitely a mistake I see in a lot of the athletes that I'm working with. And so part of that pre-sleep routine would be putting away the electronic devices. We all know that. Potentially wearing blue light blocking glasses, taking a warm bath or shower, doing relaxing, breathing techniques, stretching, just preparing the mind and body for sleep. We can't just kind of flip a switch and expect to be wide awake, especially in an athlete situation where they have those evening competitions. They are sleeping in a new environment. We got to have that good pre-sleep routine that they can incorporate no matter where they are, and will help improve the ability to fall asleep quicker and improve overall sleep quality. So there's a couple of techniques related to that that I can expand on. Number one is the 4-7-8 breathing technique. So having some kind of breathing technique, and this is useful for before sleep, but also if you wake up during the middle of the night, having the 4-7-8 breathing technique. So breathe in for 4 seconds, hold your breath for 7, breathe out for 8 seconds, and repeat that 4 times. Another one would be maybe snake breathing. So you breathe in and then like hiss out like a snake. And the important thing here with these breathing techniques is that you're breathing out longer than you're breathing in. And that helps activate the parasympathetic nervous system, that relaxation system. So having a breathing technique in your toolkit is important. Also a cognitive technique. So for me, I like the cognitive shuffle. I think of a word such as bedtime. I imagine all the objects that I can that start with B. So ball, baby, bus, banana, like imagine these objects and then move on to the next letter when you can't think of any more. So E, eagle, egg, ear, you know, D, deer, you know, you get the point. And so having a cognitive technique, and this one in particular simulates what we do when we're falling asleep. We start imagining objects. You could also do color. You could pick a color and imagine all the objects that you can with that color is another technique that I even use with my kids. And then it's really important if you are waking up during the middle of the night to get up out of bed. You've tried the breathing technique. You've tried the cognitive technique. This happened to me last night, actually. I woke up wide awake. It was 2 a.m. I didn't look at the clock, which is good. And then I tried the breathing. I tried the cognitive. I tried reading in low light and still was not falling asleep. So I got up out of bed and I only returned back to bed when I was sleepy. And so that's an important aspect as well. So having kind of some of these, that was kind of a very long-winded answer for the pre-sleep routine, but some good techniques to help you prepare your mind and body for sleep, whether that be before bed, which is kind of what I'm highlighting here, but also if you wake up during the middle of the night. I would say another mistake that athletes make is related to napping. So they just don't nap. They don't schedule nap as a part of their training. And what we found in our research is that about 80% only napped, you know, 2 or less times per week in the 200 Canadian Olympic national team athletes that I was working with. And so napping is huge. It is a way to make up for some lost sleep at night, but also a way to boost alertness more than even what you could get with caffeine. And so having napping as a part of your routine is really important for athletes, especially who, you know, they're traveling a lot, they're on the road, they have late night competitions, and they just can't maybe get enough sleep at night. And so to supplement with a nap, preferably less than 90 minutes. We don't want to go beyond that because then we're starting to hinder the ability to fall asleep at night. And in most instances, I mean, even if you only have a 10-minute opportunity, this nap is going to increase alertness. It's going to boost mood. It's going to just boost performance in general than those who don't nap. So even if you are getting enough nighttime sleep, even adding in that short power nap, less than 20 minutes, is going to be really key for athletes' performance.
If you had to name a time for the ideal length of a nap, Dr. Amy, what would you say?
Okay, as far as the duration, I would say less than 30 minutes. And the reason for that is you aren't then getting into the deeper stages of sleep where you're waking up feeling groggy. And this does vary from person to person. So if I'm really sleep deprived, I may want to limit my nap to less than 20 minutes if I am sleep deprived, and I'll likely get into that deep sleep very quickly. And for example, like a swimmer who has to get up early for training times, pool time, in those instances, I'd recommend a longer nap because they just can't get to bed early enough. Their melatonin isn't being released early enough. You know, a lot of strength and conditioning coaches may schedule like I don't want to say a lot, but they may schedule an early morning strength session. And really, I've gotten to arguments with people where they're like, well, the athlete's just being lazy. They just got to go to bed early. And, you know, in my mind, I'm like, no, that has nothing to do with it. Their biology is not allowing them to go to bed early enough because their melatonin is being released later.
One of the last questions I do want to ask you, and we've touched on melatonin a bit, but sleep aids, and I know where I'm from, magnesium and melatonin are probably the two biggest ones. Could I get your thoughts on both of them?
Yes, I'm actually, full disclosure, I'm part of the scientific advisory board on a nutrition company who is developing a sleep product. So they have a lot of other products, but they're wanting my expertise to develop a sleep product. So I have looked a lot into this research. And what I recommended to them was to include magnesium glycinate, because glycinate itself helps with sleep quality. It's easily digestible. But I think that's the bonus with the glycinate version, is that it does help with sleep quality. So magnesium glycinate and then melatonin potentially. So they have, part of this company is they do personalized nutrition. And so there may be some individuals who don't really need melatonin. There may be others that do, you know, so melatonin has been shown to be good, especially for shifting our circadian rhythms to an earlier time, not necessarily as it relates to falling asleep quicker. I mean, there is maybe a 5-minute improvement. But more related to shifting our circadian rhythms to an earlier time is where melatonin becomes really useful. And then the other product that I wanted to add was tart cherry juice. So tart cherry juice has been shown to boost melatonin. And in some studies, especially in sleep disordered patients, we're looking at 60 to 80 minutes more of sleep when these individuals are taking tart cherry juice in the morning and the evening, you know. So that was another thing that I recommended. Ashwagandha was looking pretty decent when I was looking at those studies. I mean, of course, there's not a lot of research in that area, but from what I could tell, it seemed like a decent option for people to try. And it also helps with reducing anxiety as well. So if you have a really anxious athlete. And of course, I want to preface this, I'm not a medical doctor, I'm a scientist, but ashwagandha was one thing. I looked into chamomile, didn't really show much with chamomile, with the valerian root, had kind of mixed results. Some of those other ones just, I think, would maybe be useful for certain individuals, but overall the data didn't really show much promise into including that. So those are the three main ingredients that I recommended to them: magnesium glycinate, melatonin, and tart cherry juice. And another one I told them, I was like, if we can make this work, we should really look at kiwi fruit as a potential, because there are a few studies out there showing that eating 1 to 2 kiwi fruit about an hour before bedtime improves overall sleep quality. So I was working with an MBA team who was really struggling at this location at high elevation. And for them, you know, it was fascinating to me because I was working with them and the assistant coach texted me a picture of, you know, they had 4 nights at this location. They lost both games. And they were heading back to, they lost two games away. They came back, they won two games at home, and they were heading back to location. And they were getting pretty desperate. And I was working with them all this time, and they, you know, sent me a picture of some of the products that they were including. And one of the products had 10 milligrams of melatonin. And I was like, no, let's, you know, because if you have too much melatonin, you can wake up feeling groggy, you know, and that can last throughout the day. And so those were the products that I recommended to them, was the tart cherry juice, the magnesium, and the melatonin, no more than 3 milligrams. You know, so those can really make a difference. And I also said, let's give the athletes some kiwi fruit before bedtime. You know, let's incorporate some of these techniques to help them fall asleep. And they ended up winning on the road. So I felt pretty good about that. You know, so yeah, I wouldn't go too crazy with the supplements. Personally, I don't use supplements to help me fall asleep. But if I were a professional athlete or an elite athlete, you know, I might change my tune a little bit.
Absolutely. Last question before I let you go, Dr. Amy, because I know we're nearly hitting time. It's a big rising emerging area, especially in the US, and it started in our part of the world, Oz and New Zealand, CBD. And one of the biggest advertisings that they'll use for CBD is sleep quality, and it'll help you fall asleep faster. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, see, I get a lot of questions about CBD. I get athletes messaging me, you know, should I be taking CBD? And the answer is like, why are you taking it in the first place? Number one. So do you have an underlying sleep disorder? Is it related to insomnia? You know, there are much better treatments out there. And I know taking a pill or taking a substance, you know, is easier in a lot of cases. And so maybe during a season when you're trying to get through and you're really struggling with sleep, then that may be a good option. I'm not saying CBD in general, but I'm saying taking a substance, melatonin and maybe a sleep aid, although I don't recommend that. So CBD, there are mixed results. So I don't want to discount these subjective reports that I'm hearing, these anecdotes that I'm hearing that CBT is amazing. However, you know, there's research to support that it really is mixed results. It may be a lot having to do with the placebo effect. And in general, I think I remember CBD being useful for pain. So in particular, maybe suffering from an injury, that may be a good utility for that. But in general, it wouldn't be enough for me to recommend.
Yeah, no, that's a good answer. Like most things in science, we need more work. But anyway, Dr. Amy, that's all I've got for you today. But thank you so much. I know, like I said, it was a bit of a kerfuffle to get you on, and I'm glad we could finally find the time to get on. Yeah, that's going to be so useful. That's going to be so useful for not only the athletes that listen in, but everyday people. Dr. Amy, thank you so much. Before I let you go, though, people want to find you on socials. They want to reach out to you. They listen to this and go, oh, man, like, I've got some issues I need Dr. Amy to help me with. How do they get in contact with you?
So I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Sleep for Sport. I'm also developing a website, sleepintowin.com. That should be up pretty soon, maybe hopefully by the time this podcast airs. But yeah, those are the main areas people can find me.
Very last thing, Dr. Amy, what about the association between TikTok and sleep? Because I've been falling victim to staying up too late watching TikTok videos. Is there anything emerging in that field lately?
Yeah. I mean, there's that addictive element. I mean, social media can have that addictive element, and even like Netflix. And you're right, though. You gotta put it away hour before bedtime. Just put the device away. Keep it like, for me, I keep my phone downstairs when I'm sleeping too. I don't have it like right by my bed, tempting me to reach for it in the middle of the night.
Another good bit of advice. So put away your phone and delete the TikTok app, everybody. But anyway, Dr. Amy, thanks so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. What an episode. I know we all have an inherent understanding of the importance of sleep, but now we are really starting to see just how much good quality sleep is at the foundation of not only athletic performance, but health. Be sure to follow Dr. Amy on socials to make sure you stay up to date with everything to do with catching adequate Z's. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.